Yes, we were just discussing, Dr. Logan, about the later years of university since 1958. Can you tell me, can you continue your QMS and tell me what's gone on since then?
Well, Tuamest, of course, the period which Tuamest deals with was a definite period. I'm not at all sure that there was a break in the history of university in 1958. What was the year of Dr. Mackenzie's retirement? Do you remember?
62.
Dr. Mackenzie's years from 1944 were years of immense activity and definite transition from a much smaller university to with smallest number of faculties to a very much larger university with increased number of faculties and institutes and schools and so on. And it created problems in itself which required administration, which were different from the problems that the university had faced with in some respects previously, question of staff and numbers and so on. But from Dr. Mackenzie brought into the university, introduced into the university, certain ideas that were necessary, it seemed to me, to the administrative arrangements of this larger, much larger institution. I don't know much about these things, and so I don't want to talk very much about them. But his successor, Dr. MacDonald, is a much younger man, and he has a very definite ideas of his own about method of administration, about the division of subjects and division of faculties and so on. And it's only natural that there should be marked changes in some, at least, of the administrative arrangements within the university. Now, I'm more or less retired now. In fact, I've been retired for a number of years, and I don't want to talk about them. I'd much rather not talk about these things because I'm not closely in touch with them. But I'm one of the people who admire Dr. MacDonald very greatly, as I did Dr. Mackenzie, who faced into a situation that was quite different from the present situation which UBC is faced in the province. But this present administration has other problems, plenty of them, and are dealing with them aggressively, and I don't want to say more about it.
The problem of huge number of students in the lower years of the arts and science faculties especially, they can't deal with this by letting out to the different cities in BC junior colleges, because then they wouldn't have that many facilities, would they? So how could they combat this?
Well, that, of course, is one of the very, very difficult problems of internal administration. I think there is a very useful function for the smaller colleges where it's impossible to set up a college of university stature, because of financial reasons and questions of staff and so on. But a place, Victoria College, Victoria University, is a good example of the way that kind of college develops, if it's allowed to develop and if it's encouraged to develop. Victoria College was same as UBC. It was a college of McGill to begin with. And it carried on as a college of McGill. And then it dropped for a little while after the war, World War I, because UBC hadn't got the money then. They never have had the money, but they certainly didn't have the money then to go on and administer Victoria College as well. So all of the university work of UBC began in Vancouver, and Victoria College was dropped a short time, and then eventually, owing to things easing up, Victoria College opened up as a college, giving 2 years of work, and some of the very finest students we've ever had in UBC came out of Victoria College, which had a couple of years only in their curriculum. Now that's the sort of thing that can develop in the smaller colleges. And it's I think my wife's up. But should I perhaps I'd better go. Well, I've always felt that a junior college has a very definite place in the higher education of our province, and so long as it isn't regarded as a final job, excepting with those who can't go any farther, but as a preparation for advanced work in the senior years of university, one can only say that Victoria College, for a number of years, quite a large number of years, was in the state, had the status of a junior college, what talked about as a junior college these days. UBC itself began under the auspices, if you like, of McGill, as a first year, giving 1 year, and then 2 years, and then 3 years, and then presto in 1915, came UBC itself with 4 years, but McGill handed over 3 years of preparatory work to UBC, and upon my soul, I don't think that UBC ever had a greater year than the class of 1916, which was their first graduating class, and which had 3 years of work in what we would call today a junior college, which was then administered by McGill under the sort of general direction, if you like, a result of the work that McGill established out here in British Columbia. But it was a junior college. Does that sort of answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. UBC seems to have just been operated, as you mentioned in your book, under a series of crises. For instance, there was the First World War, the hard trouble getting started, and then the cramped quarters, the move to Point Grey finally, and then the Depression came along, and then the Second World War, and then the post-war cramped, crowded quarters as well. Well, was there anything after that that's been critical? Any crises since it, or has it all been smooth sailing in the last 10 years, did you say?
Well, but there I've got to the last 10 years, which carries on back to 1955. Again, I was out of the active, very active work of the university as head of the classics department, but the impression that I get is that we're always in a crisis in the expanding life of a great university. I've just come back from some weeks in Eastern Canada when I visited Dalhousie and Fredericton and McGill, and upon my soul, I think they are in sort of crisis in a way of their life, but it's not anymore the sort of critical situations which confronted UBC in 1932, when there was a definite danger that the UBC would be closed.
Why?
As a result of the lack of money, the government in Victoria thought they didn't have enough money to keep the university going, and the Kidd Report, which was a report of leading businessmen in Vancouver, and was had their imprimatur, it had their signatures on it, was given to Mr. Ptolemy, Premier Ptolemy, in Victoria, advocated the closing down of the university, setting up a number of scholarships for the people who got highest marks in matriculation, and sending them to Eastern universities. And that was a definite statement and judgment of a very large number of our leading businessmen in British Columbia. Now, those same men today are giving vast sums of money to maintain and enlarge and maintain the work of our graduates and work of the university generally.
Well,
which is an interesting position. Beg your pardon?
Why during the Depression did they advocate communism?
Lack of money. It was much cheaper in their view to establish scholarships which would send a certain number of our best students, and we still have a lot of people who think that only the best students should go to university anyhow, wasting public funds if we send people who can't get high marks on examination and so on. But that's an argumentative question. It's a question you can argue about for the end of time. But there was this idea, which is a very definite one, because of the serious lack of money in Victoria, in the treasury, not enough money to maintain the university, and that by sending the scholars to Eastern Canadian universities, Alberta and Manitoba and McGill and Toronto and Dalhousie and Queens, that it would be an actual saving of costs of higher education. And on paper it looked all right. But when the government looked at it, they washed it up. They said, no, we can't do that. We can't do it because education is something that our young people, we should look after ourselves, for our own young people, and not hand them over to somebody in Alberta or the institutions in Alberta to look after their education. Now there you had the view of the government on the one side, and on the other side, the view of quite a large body of men who brought in the Kidd Report. Mr. Kidd was the chairman of that committee, and he had on the committee quite a large number of our top business and industrial men in the province.
So it was the businessmen who considered higher education a luxury rather than the government itself.
Well, I wouldn't say that either.
Well, the government said, no, we can't do that.
But as a luxury, no. It wasn't regarded exactly as a luxury, but it's regarded as something that they couldn't afford. There are certain things you can afford, and certain things you can't afford. That was one of the things that the province could not afford. But I don't think they regard it as a luxury so much. I wouldn't put it that way,
Diana. Something that had to be expanded while they were in the Depression.
Yes. But the government, my own view was, of course, I was involved in this. I was teaching. I didn't say much about it, but I was teaching. I was in the university and remember the faculty and watched this thing going on. My own idea was that the government was right. The government saw the spiritual and the real essential community values of what the university was doing. And there was a time in the early days of the university that we were looked upon as doing work for a sort of glorified high school. And that picture of the university was passed around Vancouver among a good many of the businessmen in our city. A glorified high school. Dean Buchanan, who was our Dean of Arts in those days, referred more than once in his public addresses to the Rotary and other places, and he spoke with, he had a very, he's a very frank tongue, and he spoke what he thought. He was Dean of Arts, of course, at that time for many years. And Dean Buchanan used to go for this notion of the work we were doing in the university as the work of a glorified high school, where he said he was quoting the expression that had been used by some of his friends who might have been present at the meetings that he was addressing.
What did he say? How did he rebut it?
Pardon?
How did Dean
Buchanan? Oh, well, I wouldn't go into that. That's all belongs in the argument of the value of higher education. We had to prepare our teachers. We had to prepare our teachers of the teachers. We have to prepare men for scientific work in every branch almost of industry. And these are things which belong in the university's the ambit and orbit, if you like, of the university's work.
Why does UBC have such a high caliber of faculty right the way through its history, even in spite of these crises?
Why? Why not?
Well, surely, you know, when things are going badly, a lot of people can't believe. But UBC faculty has always been such high quality, hasn't it?
Well, I'm prejudiced. I'm a prejudiced person. I shouldn't answer that question.
Do you think maybe that the university is doing more for the businessman or industry now than it did when it was so small?
I wouldn't say that. What's happened in the university is that the university has enlarged its scope and enlarged its opportunities of study for the students as the community developed and as the need for the demand for university education appeared in the community. I'm speaking now of the development, say, of the Faculty of Commerce, and a good deal of our science development in the faculties of the Faculty of Science. The Faculty of Applied Science is a case in point also. The development, the enlargement of the faculties has taken place in response to the demand in the communities. Our Faculty of Commerce today is one of the large faculties. I don't know how many, we have several, I don't know, perhaps over 1,000 students. And apart from night classes galore. But that is because business now demands, and industry, in certain brackets of industry, work demands a kind of training which can only be done post-high school. And the place seems to be here in British Columbia, seems for that sort of training, seems to be in our university. But when there was a great cry in 1914-13, before the war, World War I, in the Kootenai country, where there was money was pouring into British Columbia and pouring out of British Columbia, into mining and out of mining. And Kootenai was the center of a school, sort of school of mines up there. And when the university began to be talked about, they said, oh, you people have got no idea of the value of what the university can do, and you must get the school of mines going, if you ever get any university going. Well, hardly any students came to the applied science faculty in those early days, because there was not the demand for it. Although it was required, and a certain number was required, there wasn't the demand in a big sense, the way there has been in the past 2 decades, I suppose, or 3, for people to be trained in the applied sciences. That's the development of the country. And that is on the same sort of scale as the development in commerce, in the Faculty of Commerce. But you have it in other departments too, history and, oh, the natural sciences are developed in a marvelous way. Biology, zoology, history, English.
Why history?
Why?
Because we don't see that much of a demand from...
There's a new process of studying history that's been in operation now for 15, 20 years. And we've gone deeply into Canadian history, among other things, American history.
At UBC?
Yes, elsewhere, but at UBC also, because we're doing work on the par with the work that's being done anywhere in Canada, in I would say almost in all subjects.
On a par?
I would say so.
Oh, yes, surely. I would too.
I'm speaking of Toronto and McGill, which are the old place, and Queens. I spent a week in Queens. I just got home after spending a week there. But they're developing on the same sort of scale as we are, only not on such a big... They haven't the same number of students, but they've... between 4,000 and 5,000 students. There's something over 4,000 students at Queen's. But they're developing in the same sort of way. And they're an older place than we are. And they've provided us with a good many teachers in the past.
Do you think we could call UBC a great university?
You bet. Not a doubt of it.
We can.
Certainly.
Why?
Why? Since 1930, our students, graduates, have been accepted for graduate work in all the great universities of this continent and in Britain. That's literally true. Now, the product of any ordinary institution of learning doesn't have that kind of acceptance. That's in my experience. I mean, that is an evidence that it's true. But we have today men coming to our staff from some of the finest schools of learning anywhere in the world, particularly in Europe. We're getting a large number of European scholars here in languages, in science, in the applied sciences, in business, economics. We've got French teachers from France and Central Europe and so on, as well as from the United Kingdom, Oxford and Cambridge and Leeds and Sheffield and Bristol and these newer, some of the older universities of the old land, Edinburgh, of course, and Glasgow. Belfast. But we have as fine a drawing magnet, if you like, for the teaching profession, for teachers, scholars and teachers, I think as any of the Western universities. We can't compete in stature with places like, University of California, Stanford, I'm not sure about Stanford, certainly University of California, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, University of New York, some of the older institutions, but we're doing as good work with in the same medium of work, in the same areas of work, as is done in the great universities, the other great universities of our continent. Not in numbers. These numbers of places like Minnesota and Wisconsin and so on, the numbers there of students is just incredible. But the work of it is all right. One, I was visiting in Nova Scotia, in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, which is the center of Acadia, Mount Allison University. Is that right, Mount Allison, or is it Acadia?
Acadia.
It's Acadia. Acadia.
Rocky.
Don't put that in.
No.
Acadia. Acadia. I don't know. I've been in trouble over that already, and I would want it in. No thanks. But in Wolfville, I was went down there to see the president of Wolfville, of Acadia, whom I know. But I had found through meeting an old friend in McGill, who was just retired as professor of chemistry, one of the members of the class of 1917 UBC, Professor John Menne. I had dinner with him there, and he said, "Oh, you must, if you're in Nova Scotia, you must visit Lennox Mills in Wolfville." Well, there I had an evening with Lennox Mills, an afternoon with him, who was one of the members of the class of 1916, and was a member of my Greek class in his third year of McGill College, the year before winter of 1314. The year before the first year of UBC, and then he graduated the following year in the spring of 1916, and went as a Rhodes Scholar to Oxford, and then he became a graduate student again, I think, and finally on the staff of the University of Minnesota, and he retired there last year as the head of the Department of Political Science in the University of Minnesota. Now he's lecturing in Acadia as an emeritus professor.
How many students did he say were in Minnesota?
Oh, 40 or 50,000. I don't know. Immense numbers. I don't know. I don't remember. I wouldn't want to be quoted on that.
Yeah.
But the numbers are, yes, it is that. But there he was one of our graduates, and he was at the head of the Department of Political Science in the University of Minnesota.
Well, now how would these scholars from Europe and all over North America have heard about UBC and the beach? Would it have been a slow
process
building up our reputation?
No, we don't recruit that way. Our calendar goes everywhere. And these people want a release, or they want a place to work and study. I asked a young man in our department a few nights ago who was a graduate of London University. I said, "Why in heaven's name did you come to UBC to graduate work?" He's doing graduate work in classics in our department. "Oh, you want to change?" I shouldn't really, this won't be on the records, please. But he said, "I just wanted to change and wanted to get away to a free life place," and he'd seen our calendar and it suited him, so he thought he could get some work here. But that's the sort of thing. You get a sort of an influence that sets going by word of mouth, or just by one's own intuitions and intuitive wish to try work somewhere else. But he's only at the graduate level. But people on the continent, we have people from Czechoslovakia, Professor Krajina, who was in botany, biology, a wonderful scholar, a very scholarly person, is a refugee. He had dreadful experiences in his own country. Terrible, at the hands of the Germans. But he's here, I suppose, as a refugee, possibly originally, I don't know, but he's stayed, loves it. And we have half a dozen physicists who are building up our physics, Department of Physics. I hope you've talked to George Volkov.
Just about him.
George is a white Russian. But he has in his department, he succeeded to Gordon Shrum, and his department has several men of European scholarship, names, with a name for each scholarship in their own work, and same mathematics.
And they've come through the reputation, I guess, of Volkov, too.
Why, yes. And Gordon Shrum, of course, has done a lot Gordon Shrum has done an awful lot because he believes in that department and in the work of his department, and he's combed the places, you know, all over the place to get the best material. But I'm sure you will have had some access to physics, haven't you?
I've spoken to Dr. Shrum.
Have you? Yes, a lot. Well, Dr. Shrum can tell you as much about UBC as any other living person. Certainly, he came to UBC. I remember as a young teacher in his first year here. He came in 1922, I think. 22, 23. I was just back from war. He was just back from war, the military medal.
In the First War?
Yeah. Yeah. He had a wonderful, interesting career.
How do you think, what will they do with the younger students in the first and second years if UBC is going to concentrate mainly on postgraduate work?
Well, that's a figure of speech, really, Diana. You have to provide the best that's going in British Columbia for graduate work. Now, that's all, that's really what that means. And people like H.R. McMillan, Dr. McMillan, others who see the point of that and have funds to give to it are right behind Dr. McDonald in this move. And it just means, you see, it's terribly expensive. A piece of equipment, $200,000. My son is working in Queens this year in the science lab in Queen's University on photosynthesis or something of that sort in the growth of certain species of trees in which he's interested. He's a graduate in forestry of UBC post-World War II. And the equipment that he has there is such that his department in the Canadian government could not afford to give it to him. But then they said, you go to Queen's and we'll back them up, we'll give them all we can to support this equipment. But a piece of equipment there would cost probably $30,000, just for one graduate student. And there are about four or five of them in the area of work that he's doing. I only use that as an example, which is on the lower bracket of costs for this equipment. And of course, books, and all this, terribly expensive for one student or two or three. If you want to be known as a university which gives graduate work in this, that, or the other subject, you've got to answer the question, well, what equipment have you got? And there you're right up against it. So Dr. McDonald will say, we're going to make graduate studies the objective, one of our main objectives. Well, of course we are, because we want to give our young people all the best they can get right to the top. And that costs an awful lot of money. So only one institution in the province will give it in certain subjects. But Victoria College is going to be a liberal arts college. They're not going to go on and do science and so on as we will in UBC, but they'll give graduate work, because graduate work in history and literature and so on is not so costly.
But we're not going to lose the liberal arts.
Oh, no. Oh, dear me, no. No, indeed. There'll be no reduction there, I wouldn't think. Certainly not. That isn't interchangeable as between one place and another. It's basic in all higher education. Yeah. Scientists and everybody. You can't. There's no division, really, in this thing that TCTS knows. Has given out that there's a basic division between the scientist and the humanist. There isn't any such division. There isn't. It's all one. Knowledge is all one. One costs more, and you have to have more stuff to look at and handle. That is science. But it isn't science. It isn't intellectually. It's not different. The scientist who makes that distinction between himself and people who have literature and interest in literature and philosophy and so on is making a mistake. What he needs is he's getting some sort of cover for his own to defend himself. A defensive sort of cover. He didn't need it. I don't think. However, that's another subject altogether.
What special quality has UBC that sets it off and distinguishes it, do you think? Any special feeling?
Oh, I don't know. It's so hard to answer that question.
Egregious, in the true sense of the word. Yes.
Well, that's all right. One would say that it is so. That I think that I don't know any university of stature that has a more distinguished graduate body than we. And one could name a great many of them. But
what do they do? Do they go on?
They go on into business, industry, press work. We have the present president for the second time running of the Canadian. Canadian-American Press Association in Stuart Key. That's an example in the press. We have a young man who does a great deal of talking on television in Ottawa, Norman DePoe, who was in my classes years ago. And every time I see Norman's face on the screen, on the television screen, I think of him in the back seat in one of my Latin classes. But we have two or three presidents of universities.
There's one president of the University of Nevada.
Yes, he's one of my students too, Charlie Armstrong. Mm-hmm. And he's been there for some years now, quite some years. He's a person who wouldn't give a sort of slant on UBC. He was here in the 30s. He's a Victoria College boy, one of the best students Victoria College ever sent us. Charlie Armstrong. And I think Carl Tallman is the president of a science university down in the United States somewhere.
He used to be an American embassy in Tokyo, Clark says here. He was with the American, a geologist?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, great name really. Geology. Our chancellor, who had a very distinguished career in World War II, in government, in Ottawa.
Who is this?
Mrs. Ross, Chancellor Ross.
She was head of the war something board, right?
Yes, tariff prices. And controller of gas and oil. That is centrally in Ottawa.
What's her name? The government. What was
her name? Turner, Phyllis Turner.
And she graduated from UBC?
Yes, class of 25. And her son was one of the graduates of about, 48 perhaps, Member of Parliament for one of the most difficult constituencies in Canada, I should think, a mixed double language constituency in Montreal. A very able person. Chick, he's known as Chick Turner.
John
is his name.
No, I just wanted to say it for the tape.
Yes. Well, his name is John, of course, but everyone knows him as Chick Turner. Very remarkable young man, in my opinion, my view.
So the UBC certainly contributed to Canada and to the world in this respect of its fine students.
I'd say so. One of the best people writing the classics examination in Oxford 2-3 years ago was one of our UBC students, Terry Penner, who got a first in his classical examination and passed without any viva voce examination, which is unusual. And he'll get his PhD this year in Oxford. That's in classics. Some of our Rhodes Scholars over there have done extremely well in their work in Oxford. John Madden is one of them, more recently in physics, nuclear physics. One of them is a professor St. Anthony's College in Oxford, professor of economics, reader in economics, yes, professor of economics. Not professor really at Oxford, they call him. He's a tutor, a don. Reader perhaps in economics. But one of the, having been appointed there after having taken his examinations in Oxford. That's John Halliwell, also a great rower, was coaching, coached the St. John's College boat couple of years ago. But one could go on. I think that one could even mention one of our great conservative political leaders, Davy Fulton, as a UBC man that we'd be very proud to claim, I think, as a graduate. But however, as I say, their name is Legion. One doesn't want to. Another one is Jimmy Sinclair, the Honorable James Sinclair. If he'd remained in politics, he could quite easily have become gone farther. I wouldn't want to say where.
What else has UBC contributed then to the world, besides its academic level and its students, graduates?
Well, it's so hard to, once one makes comparisons, one's in difficulties. Comparisons are odorous, as one of Shakespeare's people said. I think we've had a very good name in our contribution to public service. Norman Robertson, for example, is the senior member at present of the External Affairs Civil Service Department, and it has been there for quite a number of years as the senior man in that department. He's been our ambassador in London and in Washington, a high commissioner, ambassador in Washington.
To go on now,
That's the sort of way in which we've contributed. I don't know. We have a good many professorships in Canada and elsewhere. I mentioned John Menney, who was a member of the class of 1917, professor of chemistry at McGill. Dr. Weld, who was head of the medical school, I think, one of the senior professors in Dalhousie. You'll be interviewing him, I guess. And then Dauphiné, who was James Dauphiné in Toronto, is head of perhaps the medical school, I'm not sure, in Toronto. Now, these are not negligible positions. They're positions of high-ranking contributory value in terms of what's good for Canada. But when you think about it, there's just one thought long enough about it, one could get a very large entry on the credit side, what Canada owes to our university. We are more than most Canadian universities, pan-Canadian. By that I mean that we've sent our young people to other places to go on with their work because we're a young university. And those men today, like Norman DuPont and Norman Robson, for example, are elsewhere, from here to Halifax and right away through in the States as well. We're widely represented and in the UK. People like Carrie Warren, for example, is known. They're known in various types of life and work, various activities in different parts of the country.
Carrie Warren's geology.
Geology.
Well, Dr. Logan, now, about this special quality that UBC might have, what could you say about that?
Well, again, I have to say it's a difficult question to answer, Diana. There is something that's different in the spirit of our university. It's been brought into the institution by its students. I think outside influences have had their part. We're a big province. Our people tend to think in large terms, spatially as well as in other ways. And that creates an atmosphere in the university which is large. It's not controlled or controllable, as far as that goes, by the walls and the books and the library and so on. But it doesn't mean that we don't value those things. The library and its contents and so on, we don't hug them to ourselves and keep them to ourselves. I've just been in Kingston. I noticed a very great difference between the campus there and our campus. Students were just assembling. It seemed quieter, it seemed more settled, more staid. Now, our students going to McGill, which is somewhat the same sort of thing, have the same, they like it. But when they come back to UBC, they like it. There's a difference, there really is a difference between the campus spirit in my own alma mater, which is McGill, and Queens, and Dalhousie, the same, and UBC. There's a kind of freedom of action, whatever it is, in terms of the undergraduate life, which permeates the campus at UBC.
Is it more casual, or
it could be that. I'm not sure that it is. It's
wear it as if they are enjoying it?
Well, certainly. You bet. Certainly. I don't know what it is. I wouldn't say it's much casual, but it's certainly is very, it's very not academic. It's youthful. I think that's the word I want. Youthful. A youthful approach to the whole business of education. Here yesterday, we had one of the boys up there with a sign, carrying a sign, telling students not to pay their second term fees. Now you wouldn't find that kind of thing at one of the older universities in the East at all.
Why?
They'd pay them. I don't know. It's a youthful approach to the problems of living, perhaps. Well, one thing that has always been characteristic from the beginning of UBC is this question, is their autonomy, the student autonomy. And that did not originate in UBC. It was handed on to them by McGill. And the first constitution, the very first constitution of the Alma Mater Society, was drawn up by a committee of which I had the honor of being a member. And Sherwood Lett was, and his wife, Mrs. Evelyn Story, and the third member who was chairman, were members of that committee. And they wrote into the first constitution this notion of autonomy, and even a student court was something that was foreseen at the very beginning.
This was handed down to them from
McGill? At the very beginning. I have a copy of, I think, the Constitution there, perhaps.
But
I'm not sure.
But then you say that McGill
had McGill College in Vancouver.
Not McGill BC. University.
Well, McGill BC had the same sort of spirit, only we again were a little freer in McGill BC than in the old place of McGill, in Montreal. But I don't think that there perhaps is any university in Canada that has had, certainly is not so in places like Wolfville and Acadia and so on, and to the same extent as UBC, this spirit of undergraduate autonomy and insistence on it. And I think we've carried it, it's gone as far as it's possible for it to go. In the Act, the University Act, discipline was, well, I think I mentioned that in the early part of 2MS, the discipline of the university was to be in the hands of the dean, or the officials of the university. But they never, I've never known them hardly ever to exercise discipline. This other body, which is the student body, have practically carried that burden, or load, if you like, for the administration, and it's a mighty good way to have it done. I think.
Mm-hmm. You think what?
That's what it.
Okay. Now, what was you trying to ask?
The part that we've had, the UBC's had, in two world wars, which is quite remarkable. In the First World War, we were a very small student body, and there were over 600 of our boys who went over, and a good many of them were killed. A lot of decorations were won. And in World War II, I think the figures, I've given the figures in 2MS, same, I've had them for both World Wars, but it's quite a remarkable thing that UBC has, although it's so far west, and you'd think it wouldn't be associated so much with the military aspects of Canadian life, but we have had this quite unusual contribution to the to the defenses of Canada in wartime. Our officers training corps in university I'm prejudiced there, but it gets hosed. But it got hosed when it was against the will of the students. That was a good example of student autonomy. But the officers training corps is one of the best in Canada at the present time, and it has been since World War II. Gordon Shrum commanded it during the war, of course. He had 1,900 odd members, cadets, under his command, World War II, yes, on the campus.
Were you there? You weren't there in World War II?
No, I was not. I was not there in the university, yes. I was living on Vancouver Island then for 9 years. But I was pretty closely in touch with what's going on here, one way or another. Through the Senate, I was a member of the Senate during those years.
How is our extension department in comparison with other universities? Do you know whether...
Oh, it's doing great work.
It is. It's.
I'm not going to talk about that very much, but I do think it's just right at the top of extension work, of university extension work, in its breadth, in its conception, summer and winter. Summer and winter.
All around the province.
Yes. And round, yes, and it draws, the extension department here draws thousands of students in the summer. You probably know that, Diana. We have 6,000, over 6,000 to 7,000 students in the summer at their summer session. That is a feature, of UBC.
Other universities have it.
Not to the same extent. They have it, but for some reason or other, that department of our work has grown since that little baby that was born down about 1928 or so under Dean Coleman's direction for teachers. It's developed, and now credits are given, many courses of credit and so on are given at summer session. But I don't know. Well, it's various reasons are given. I think one of them is climatic. Summer here. But in the winter, I don't know what it is. There's a very close tie-in here with the people in their adult educational plans, and lectures, courses. I don't know if you've seen their pamphlet, but you read the numbers of courses and varieties of courses, which is quite remarkable.
Polish to history of religion.
Babysitting.